Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 11.
And we are dealing with the second half of Module 7, and we will continue on if we finish that material. Just an announcement on lecture that the exams are in fact up for another week. And a lot of people have asked me, why can't I put the exams up when the other ones go down? This is a common complaint from our students. In this particular instance, I did get an email with an activation request, so it's all good. But we actually use your emails for exam activation requests as an idea as to how students are travelling through the course, which is why we just do not like set our iPhones to remind us in a week or so and automatically activate the exam, because it sort of works as a how fast are these students actually working and who actually wants the exams or not. So they're up for a week. Okay, does anybody have any questions, queries, things I'd like to bring up, things I'd like to talk about before I start on the notes that I have in my file? Oh, that's a quiet bunch this morning. Alright. I better find something to read at you then. Alright. Oh, I just lost my spot in Notepad. This doesn't bode well. Alrighty, we are talking about the data link layer this morning. Now, have I talked extensively about the data link layer? Because I seem to remember getting halfway through this module, but I'm quite happy to revisit these concepts anyway. If anybody's a bit fuzzy about the data link layer. Alright. Well, we're going to explain the objectives of the... We're going to explain the role of data link layer protocols. We're going to describe how the data link layer prepares data for dropping onto the network. We're talking about the different types of media access control methods. Identify common network topologies, logical network topologies, and talk about them. And how it determines the media access control method for the network. And we're going to explain why you would even bother encapsulating packets in frames for in the first place. And we're also going to talk about the layer 2 frame structure and describe the generic fields. Okie dokie. Now, the data link layer uses media access control... media access methods and error detection techniques to ensure that data gets onto the network media in a reliable manner. A frame is the PDU for this layer. Remember how we had segments, packets, data, segment, packets, frames and bits? Does anybody remember that stuff? They're the sets of PDUs that we have. Yep, all good. Well, we're talking about the frames today. And if you haven't worked it out already, they basically wander their way down through the OSI reference layer as you go up the different chapters. So we start off at the application layer and we wander down through the presentation layer and the session layer and the transport layer and the network layer, and we're now down to the data link layer. That's how they've essentially structured the course. Some instructors love this and some instructors hate this. It just depends on who you talk to. When we're talking about stuff at the data link layer, a node is the term for a thing at this layer. We're not talking about hosts, we're not talking about servers and whatever, we are talking about nodes at the data link layer. Now, you've got to understand that there is a difference between the physical network and a difference between the logical network. Now, if we look at the difference between a physical and a logical network, if you have a number of hosts connected on a piece of coax, which is pretty ancient, you have a bus topology. You've got your one run of coax, you've got the terminators on each end, and you have a bus topology. Now, the physical topology is a bus, the logical topology is a bus. Now, if you connect the same set of workstations with twisted pair on a hub, The physical topology is a star, but the logical topology is still a bus. Does everybody understand how that works?
Yes.
Alrighty, I'm just going to go and shut the door because this stupid machine has DC offset problems with its microphone and the audio keying isn't working too well. I shall be back in just a second because I have to talk loud for the microphone to stay keyed, which probably doesn't work well for the rest of the building. So one sec. Okay. Now, am I the only one... Yes, Sabahattin.
Hi, yeah. Does logical in this context mean IP layer, or does it mean some other physical layer concept?
Look, I hate to be Mr. Obvious here, but if we're talking about the data link layer, how can it mean IP layer? That's at layer 3. So we're at layer 2. When I say logical topology, I'm talking about how the frames travel on the network media. So if you've got a wireless access point broadcasting to a cell, the logical form of the network would be how the machines see the frames, but the physical would be how the stuff's actually laid out.
Oh, I see. So it's the path of the communication.
Well... All right, let's run another example. So, I've already done my example where if you have stuff on a bus, like a coax, and you've got stuff on a hub, you basically have, physically speaking, you have a bus and a star, because the coax goes in one long run, and the hub creates a star. Now, when you... for example, change this and put a switch in, you physically have a star, but logically, because of the switch topology, you actually have a point-to-point topology for the duration that the switch opens up the paths. So physically speaking, the topology is a star, but logically speaking, the switch actually causes small point-to-point microsegments to be opened.
I see. So it's logical in the sense that from the perspective of the node, it's another node it's talking to, regardless of how the topology is laid out. It's sort of an express through it, no matter what the topology was.
Yeah. It's how the actual frames travel as far as the nodes are concerned is what we're dealing with when we talk about the logical topology, but it's how the frames travel... when we're talking about the physical topology is the actual wires and stuff we've got wired up. Now, am I hallucinating, or am I the only person who hasn't noticed? I think Discovery's got this, but I don't think Exploration does. There is no straightforward explanation of the different types of networking devices, or have I missed something? Because I don't remember seeing this, and I'm horrified that this is not in the course. And I'm about to put it in.
That is correct. You're right.
There is a bit in the Ethernet about the difference between the switch and the hub, and particularly the point that you just raised about the point-to-point connection transiently existing whilst the switch is open between those two devices. But nothing much else.
Yeah, it's pretty crummy if you ask me. I'm sort of like, well, where is a little definition that all the students can look through and go, this is a hub, this is a switch, this is a router, this is a whatever. In fact, I don't think they've got more of it in Discovery, but I don't actually remember a little summary section being written anywhere that really covers it nicely.
Is the presumption maybe that we would have taken Discovery before this?
But I don't think it's well covered in Discovery either, to be honest. I could be wrong. Feel free to disagree with me, anyone?
I did take a poke at the Discovery.
I actually thought it was pretty thorough. I'm taking Discovery, and we spent about 45 minutes to an hour discussing the differences between hubs, switches, and routers, and the difference between home routers and the large Cisco routers. I don't know that that was all curriculum-based, but Brian and Nehemiah made sure that we knew and could identify the different parts and how they worked and why they worked.
No, that's not in the curriculum, and that's, like, I'm certainly not knocking their teaching delivery here, because they probably did do 45 minutes with you guys. Because this is exploration, we're probably going to do 5 or 10 minutes, but essentially, that stuff was all pulled from general knowledge, and it wasn't actually directly from the curriculum, which is surprising. Yeah, all right. Well, anyway, my shortcomings of the opinions of the curriculum that we're delivering can wait until we're outside of lecture, but suffice it to say I've got quite a bit to say on the subject. We were discussing, actually, this is an interesting one for you. Grace works for IINet, which is an internet service provider over here, and she works on the phones doing internet tech support. And would you believe that none of the people in her call centre are trained on how to connect a wireless router into an ISP-provided modem? You know how well you do the two-router thing?
Sadly, I would believe it, having spoken to some tech supports from the ISP. That I don't think will be too unusual.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, I don't know.
Do you mean bridging or...?
No. You know where, okay, you're a home user, right? And you go down to insert favorite name of computer store. No, you call up the ISP and you buy, the router that comes with the ISP, and it's like this 4-port thing with wireless, right? So when you get your 5th computer as a user, you wander on down to insert name of big computer store and buy one of these, Belkin wireless N router things that's got like 4 LANs and a WAN port, and you connect a cable from the WAN port to your ISP router, and then you plug a whole stack of computers into the ports or wirelessly onto the Belkin, and then you wonder why the whole thing blows up and doesn't work because both routers have got internal LAN subnets of 192.168.1.x. Has anyone been here with this or heard of this?
Yes. Yeah, this happens more than just a little bit.
Alright, well let's have a little bit of a talk about the actual networking devices we're dealing with, and it seems appropriate that we talk about them here at the data link layer and possibly the physical layer anyway, but we will talk about those devices a little bit and we will have a little definition for you all. Okay, so... cables, I'm pretty sure we don't need to cover that. There are different sorts of cables. You can have them with RJ45 on the end of them. If you've got fiber, you can have them with an SC or subscriber connector on the end. A single optical fiber can be used for Toslink between home theatre systems and receivers, audio receivers and things. But usually in data communications, we have 2 fibers, one next to the other, for a send and a receive path. And they have those little subscriber connectors, which are the little sort of pin thing that pokes into the little hole that has the little swing shut door on it that stops, dust and stuff from getting into your fiber connection. And you've got wireless, which is awesome, unless you live in Shah's house where it's not so awesome. And it just goes through the air. It's probably worth mentioning, and we may cover this more in the physical layer, a lot of people don't realise that given the frequency band that you're dealing with 802.11, B, G, even, well, bang, B, A, G, and N, because we're dealing with a 2.4 gigahertz or a 5 gigahertz band, or 5.8 gigahertz band, wireless is line of sight. Now, trick question. Well, no, it's not a trick question at all. Silly question. Can anybody tell me, does wireless travel easily through double brick walls?
It depends on the frequency.
Ah, but I'm talking about 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz here. Does 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz travel well through double brick walls?
Not usually. It gets attenuated by, I don't know, probably about 40 dB.
It certainly does. Actually, this is This, yeah, only the packets get a running start. Actually, now, this might be an interesting thing to talk about for a minute or two. Now, we're going to try this, and I think you're a ham. You're familiar with the theory of DBs. Do you, and this is completely optional, you can put it off till next week, do you want to try and explain to the rest of the class what a DB is? Or is that not something you want to attempt?
I don't mind. The idea of a dB, a decibel, really comes from most people will be familiar with it from acoustics, and it's a logarithmic scale. That is to say, it's it doesn't go up in straightforward jumps. Each 10 dBs is a factor of 10 more than previously, so that, for example, 10 dBs is 10 times the strength of 1 dB, 20 dBs is 100 times the strength of 1 dB, 30 dBs 1,000 times, and so forth. So obviously the numbers become very large very fast with dB. It's what, as I say, it's what we call a logarithmic scale, and essentially it's one way of comparing two relative strengths and having a scale that's easily handleable when you get to large differences between one signal and the other. I don't know, that's not very clear, but it's the best I can do off the top of my head, Kerry.
That's a good start. Do everybody else think that was a good start? I thought that was excellent. I'm quite happy to elaborate a little bit on that. And a lot of you are probably asking, why would I even care about telling you about dBs and stuff? Has anybody ever seen, if you're looking at, say, for example, wireless equipment where it says 54 megabits at minus 67 dBm, 11 megabits per second at minus 83 dBm. Has anybody ever seen this sort of stuff written on bits of documents and specification sheets and wondered what are they on about? Yes, Steve.
I've seen it, but also on the Mac, there's an interesting little feature where if you go into the menu bar, the status menu, and if you go to the airport icon, if you hit option down arrow at that point, all of those status bar things do different functions if you hold down the option key when you open them. But anyway, in the case of the airport, the Wi-Fi, it will list out all of the Wi-Fi networks it sees and their dB strength, and a bunch of other sort of technical data, but that's the last place I've actually encountered that.
Okay. Look, and guys, I'm sorry to wander off the garden path, but these things are actually interesting and relevant, so we're going to cover a little bit of it here and possibly explain it. But now, one of the things that Mike didn't mention, which is completely understandable, is the reason we use dBms, and there are two different dB scales. There's 10 log something on N or something. I'd have to look it up. Don't even ask me. And then there's a 20 log something on N. And they're in the old CCNA curriculum. They're not in this one because that would be too complicated. But basically what happens is the reason that you've got 10 dB being, you know, 10 times more powerful and 20 dB being, you know, 100 times more powerful is because of the inverse square law. If you look at throwing a wireless signal out in all directions, you're basically, and we're assuming a theoretical, what we call isotropic radiator, which is an antenna that theoretically throws a signal out at equal strengths in all directions. So basically what happens, if you walk a meter away from the receiving antenna, your signal drops by, you know, a certain amount. You walk 2 meters away, it's half the strength again. You walk 4 meters away, it's half the strength again. So the signal falls off quite incredibly the further away you walk from the transmitter. Does that make any sense to anyone?
Yes, yep. It does.
Okay. So, now I'm not exactly sure of the specifics, and I'd have to get Mr. Taylor on here, but a dBm is something to do with 1 milliwatt of power at some particular level, and I'm not quite sure how it works, but basically 20 dBm is 100 milliwatts of power. I think that's right. Anyway, we can check that stuff. Let's pretend that it is for now. So basically what happens is you can either have a positive dB reading, which says that you're going to amplify something by something, or you're actually looking at positive that is above the zero limit. Or you can have what we call negative dBm. And a negative dBm is basically where we measure how much signal loss we have actually attained, depending on how far away we've moved away something. So if you look at a signal and it says minus 10 dBm, that's a really strong signal. If it says minus 20 dBm, that's not so good. Minus 37 dBm, okay, we're still pretty good. Minus 60 dBm, you're probably starting to get towards the weaker end of the signal spectrum. Minus 83 dBm, Windows is going to say wireless connection low. So can we see that the smaller the number, or the bigger the negative number, so we're going from minus 10, minus 20, minus 30, minus 50, minus 83, that the signal is getting weaker and weaker and weaker? So the only reason I tell you this is because if you're doing a wireless site survey, or you're actually working with this wireless technology and you're looking at these dBm readings, you've got to understand that depending on what unit it throws the signal up in the task train, I have no idea what the unit would be on the Mac, but if it says minus 20 dBm, minus 30 dBm, that's good. But if it says minus 82 dBm, you're probably going to have trouble getting your mail downloaded at the hotel. Yes, Steve?
Since there's inevitably always going to be signal loss between the transmitter and the receiver, can that number never be positive?
No, because 0 dBm is full power. 0 dBm is as good as it ever gets. As soon as you move anywhere away from that transmitter, that is a power loss ratio. You don't gain power unless you run it through an amplifier. I think that's fair to say. So, it depends on the wireless driver. It depends on the software that comes with it. Probably with a Realtek card, no. Just that I'd say that. I'm just thinking, things like NetStumbler or Kismet, well, probably NetStumbler is probably better, would show you. Basically, you need, if I remember correctly, the bar in Windows that shows signal strength is this 5-position graphical thing. Does anybody know? Apparently, hit option down arrow on the wireless icon or something. Actually, Steve might be able to explain this better than me, but I don't use a Mac.
Exactly.
Yeah, that just goes to the end of the menu. Yeah, I'm not sure quite what I'm doing wrong here, but if I press option and press down, I'll end up at the end of the menu, which is just open network preferences. I can't find the actual... I know what you mean. I've seen it done before, but I just can't seem to make it work.
Don't open the menu. Just arrow left and right until you get to the airport where it says 4-4 bars or whatever, and at that point do option down arrow.
Ah, okay, thanks. I'll try that.
All right, and get back to us with what your reading on your wireless access point would happen to be. All right, so that was a bit of a walk down the garden path, but that is... So if you've got a crummy wireless signal, and a lot of us do have a crummy wireless signal... Well, no, I don't. I've got three access points that are 100 milliwatts apiece, and they're scattered across the whole house, and they're quite fine, and they've got really good antennas. You need to understand that if you are getting crummy wireless signal, you have a couple of options. You can either improve the antennas on the access point. Any radio operator will tell you that you can receive on a piece of wire, but the amount you can transmit will depend on how good your antenna array is. I think that's a pretty fair statement to be making.
A vertical radiates badly in all directions.
That's exactly right. And you find that when you have these wireless access points and stuff, because the antennas on a wireless access point are usually the little, you know, 3 dBm sticks or 5 dBm sticks that poke up in the air, they throw signal out from every direction, and they actually are designed to sit in the center of your coverage area. Has anybody ever seen that written in the wireless manuals and stuff? Place your wireless access point in the center of the wireless coverage area? So what you can do is you can actually change the aerials out on some of these things and actually put more directional aerials, some that do like 180 degrees of coverage, or some of them that do sort of narrower degrees of coverage. And the narrower you shrink the wireless signal, the stronger the signals you're going to get. Did you succeed in getting dBms out of that thing, Sabahattin, or...? Alright, onwards and upwards. So, back to network devices. We have a number of different network devices. We have the cables, we have hubs. Now, a hub is a bridge is a device that usually connects two different network topologies together, but the bridges basically transfer the packets from one side of the network device to the other. So I'm talking about bridges from things like fiber to Ethernet, those sorts of things. Bridges don't necessarily have to do a media transform, but they can. A bridge works at layer one because it isn't smart enough to figure out what's on either side of the bridge. If you have a learning bridge or whatever, they tend to work at layer 2 and they learn which MAC addresses exist on either side of the bridge and sensibly forward packets from one side of the bridge to the other. Now, a repeater is the one I want. A repeater is a device that is used for extending the length of a network segment. Has anybody ever seen those little devices that you can stick on your twisted pair that'll make it go like 200 meters instead of 100 meters? Has anyone seen those around anywhere? So essentially they are a repeater and they boost the signal. A repeater is just like an amplifier and it boosts the signal, it attenuates the signal, it attenuates the noise, and it works at layer one. Or the physical layer. Now a bridge is a hub is a multi-port repeater. So basically a hub is a device that repeats the signal, but it repeats the signal out to every port except for the port that the signal came in on. So if you've got an 8-port hub, and these things are fairly rare, you can actually plug something into port 1 and it will repeat the signal out to port 2 through 8, but it never repeats it back out port 1 because it came in on port 1. So if we connect...
I know that there are some supposedly standalone wireless repeaters which you just place between two access points and they magnify the signal. That's not the same as WDS or other technologies like that, is it?
No, it's not. There are a number of ways of repeating wireless signals, but what these repeaters that you stand between you and the access point do is they receive the traffic from the station that's on one side of the repeater and they rebroadcast it out to the access point so that the access point gets a higher signal.
Is that just done at the radio level? No sort of knowledge of the sort of sub-layer control messages or anything like that? Just radio frequency or is there some protocol to do it?
There are a number of ways of repeating wireless, and it's a bit complicated to get into on this lecture, but there are technical reasons why WDS is a kludge, and there are other ways of repeating these things, and you need cooperation between all of the devices to make it work. But the long and short of it is that the ones you're talking about basically just repeat the signal and retransmit it to the access point, a bit like a UHF repeater, although they have enough smarts in them to get hold of a whole frame and repeat the whole frame out.
Okay, right, cool, yeah.
Okay, so you've got your hubs, which are a multi-port repeater.
You've then got a bridge. Now, a bridge is smart enough to look at what's on either side of the bridge. It's got a billy goat graph under it, if you like, that decides what's crossing the bridge and what's not crossing the bridge. You guys have billy goat graph, don't you? Or do you guys call it something else? The thing with the big troll under the bridge that tells the billy goat that it's not allowed to cross or something. One of those kid stories. Okay, you've got to make sure of these things, because if I tell some bizarre kid story and you guys have no idea what I'm talking about, the analogy sort of falls to bits. So essentially, you've got this bridge, and it actually looks at the MAC addresses in the... Okay, when the frame goes through the bridge looks at the source MAC of the frame. And if it's a simple bridge, it figures out whether the frame is coming in on port 1 or port 2, because there's only two ports, like this side or that side. And then when the frame, if it doesn't know whether the frame should be broadcast, it floods it across to the other side of the bridge. And then if a machine on the other side of the bridge responds, it remembers the machine of the other side of the bridge and says, okay, the target machine was on port 2, and it actually builds a table of what we call a table of which machines are on port 1 and which machines are on port 2, so that if two machines on the near side of the bridge try to communicate, the packet will not be unnecessarily forwarded across to the far side of the bridge. Does that make sense, hopefully? Okay, now, if you have a multi-port bridge, which is a bridge with multiple ports on it, that's a switch. Now, a switch has a table in it that is what we call content address memory, CAM, and basically as packets travel through the switch, the MAC addresses are stored in different areas of the switch depending on which packet they came in. So, say for example, you have a switch with 4 megabits of memory, or 512 kilobytes, that's what 4 megabits is. You basically split the memory into 4 or 5 different partitions, and whenever you see a source MAC on port 1, you stick it in segment 1. If you see a source MAC on port 2, you stick it on segment 2. So that when you actually look up the MAC address in the forwarding table, the switch returns the segment that it's on. That way the switch knows to switch the packets across to a specific port based on what MAC address the packets came from. Okay, so question. If we send a broadcast frame to a switch, which port is it sent to? Does anyone know?
All of them.
Yes, the broadcast frames go to all ports on the switch. If you send a broadcast address to the MAC address of all ones, it goes to all of the portions on the switch. But the point of the switch is that it's smart about what needs to be forwarded. If you have a 5-port switch and workstation 1 and workstation 2 and workstation 3 are connected on ports 1, 2 and 3, workstation 1 sends a packet to workstation 2, that goes from port 1 to port 2. Workstation 1 sends a packet to workstation 3, that goes from workstation 1, well, the initial packet goes to all the ports, and then once workstation 3 responds, the next port only goes from packets 1 to 3. And the table actually has an aging algorithm in it, so that if a port either loses link or a certain timeout occurs, the switch will age the MAC address entries and expire them from the table so that the switch can deal with changes in network topology and plugging stuff into different ports. Any questions? Yes, Steve.
Okay, so when the switch does this, how does it know, at the data layer, how does it know which machine the frames aren't destined for a specific machine, though, correct? The packets maybe, but not the frame?
Can anyone tell him? Anybody know how it would know? I'm still connected to the server, am I?
So, in other words, if machine 1 is trying to send something rather to machine 3, it's going to send a packet to machine 3, which isn't the data layer, correct?
Hang on, are we all back in sync now? Because you buffered for like 20 seconds and then came back, but I did get everything that you said.
So, long pauses, I thought that somebody dropped out. I wasn't sure what was going on there.
I'm seeing a ping of 259, so we're certainly seeing some delay. We'll see how we go. I think we're kind of back to normal to a degree, maybe. So Steve asked the question, how do we know which machine is, transmitting? The packets have got a source MAC address on them. They've got a source and destination MAC address. So as soon as the machine sends the packet out, the switch memorizes the source and destination MAC addresses at the data link layer. Well, it remembers the source ones, and that's how it knows where they are.
Yeah, that will be the frame. Presumably the packet has an IP address attached as well.
The frame has has MAC addresses in it. The packet has IP addresses. So we're dealing with frames at this layer.
Yes.
So that's what I meant when I said logical. We're still not at the IP layer. We're still talking about a end-to-end physical, MAC layer transparency. In a sense, we're still talking about frames and source MACs and destination MACs.
We're talking about MAC addresses, so we're talking about destination MAC, source MAC. So it is a logical concept, but it's a logical concept at the data link layer. You should just type SAB or something in, because it would save you typing in your whole name, because everybody's got an unfair advantage on you because their name's shorter than yours.
My nickname's actually Sebby, so I'll just type that.
Yeah, that'll do. And then we'll know who you are, and it'll be quicker. For you, anyway. So basically, this is how the switch memorizes where all of these things are. And generally, on a home switch, what you have, like if you're on a multifunction router, if we disregard the WAN side of the router, what you've got is a 5-port switch bridged to a wireless access point. So that's a 5-port switch bridged to a wireless access point. Or in fact, some of them have 4 ports, and then the 5th port of the switch chip is actually bridged into the wireless access point.
But ISPs aren't telling their customers to bridge the WAP part if they plug one router into another one.
Well, the problem with bridging the wireless access points together is that there are problems with WDS, and most wireless access points that you get for home use have an association limit of 31 stations.
Can we just have a roaming network with just two broadcasting the same SSID? That probably work if the clients are smart enough to move.
You can have them both broadcasting the same wireless network name, but the problem is you've got to have some wired infrastructure to glue it together underneath, otherwise there's no glue between the two access points. That's what WDS is for.
Yeah, that's what I do. I've just got Ethernet running to everything, but multiple access points, because these walls are pretty thick.
Yeah. But you've actually got to, like, with these home router things that want to do NAT and all that sort of stuff, they mess around at the IP layer, so you've got to take that into consideration and do reconfigurations to make multiple stuff like that work. So routers, they work at layer 3, and Cisco curriculum says if they do NAT, they work at layer 4. They are responsible for dealing with IP level stuff, so packets, IP addresses, source addresses, destination addresses, IP addresses, and they often have multiple interfaces. If you're dealing with the home routers, they tend to have LAN and WAN interfaces. If you're dealing with corporate interfaces, they may have like Ethernet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Or how many ever Ethernet they've got, and they might have fiber and ISDN and all of that sort of stuff. So does that give people a better idea of the overview of the network devices? Maybe? Yes, Steve.
So a router, though, technically is a sort of a conglomeration, potentially, of all of these. A bridge, if it handles multiple types of media. A switch, and of course then the actual router itself.
Yes, and that's why they're called integrated services router. They're kind of a mutt that consists of all of those different things stuffed into a little plastic box and manufactured in volume as cheaply as possible that you plug into to get to the internet. And anybody who's had the fortune or misfortune, depending on which one you've got, of ever using a two-wire router will know what I mean when I say as cheaply as possible. All right, any questions? Does that clarify anything for anyone?
Yeah, that's really clear about the different functions and the way that the frames propagate through the network with each device carried.
We're almost out of time, so I might stop there because I think Mike has to leave soon. If anybody has any other questions, of course, or anything else they want to talk about, I can certainly continue on about it, on with it. But that's probably all I'm going to cover today, and then I'll see how much of this you guys remember next week.
Well, I wish you all a very good day, morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are in the world, and thanks very much for the time, Kerry, and it's been another good evening. Night.
No worries. Night.